Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about focusing on the Constitution, which is why we give you this content. So hopefully this content can be applicable as you learn, pray, and act. And therefore, by the way, you're more than welcome to join Loudoun Liberty and the daily prayer that they have and become a part of the prayer circle for the Constitution and saving America and so forth. But anywho, with all of that, welcome back, Tammy. And
thank you.
Well, Tammy's, you know, getting to the point of opening up the microphone, that kind of gives Sean the segue to, hey, open up yours as well and welcome back.
I'm open.
So, sorry, folks, that we actually covered no content yesterday, but that's okay. Having the details kind of come out is, I mean, in 1 hour, we're only talking and speculating, you know, the things, but bottom line, until you start meeting and until you actually, because when we get into this, when I finally get that final article published, you're going to realize that at your county government level, your county commissioners are going to have a multitude of committees. They're going to have an infrastructure committee. They're going to have an education committee. They're going to have, because that's how we really should be doing it. Driving it at the, because the fundamental republic that should be influencing our lives on a day-to-day basis is our county government. That's where our representatives are. So that's where these discussions need to be, so that as we prepare ourselves to create a constitution for the county, we will know whether, you know, we want to restrict the state from having full control over education, or to what degree we want them to have any control over it, if that all makes sense. But getting back to content, because we completely erred yesterday by not covering anything, the Articles of Confederation were literally in the last article, because Article 12 was the one we just kind of ended up on, that all bills and credit emits, monies borrowed and debts contracted by or under the authority of Congress before the assembling of the United States in pursuance to the present Confederation shall be deemed and considered as a charge against the United States for payment and satisfaction whereof the said United States and the public faith are hereby solemnly pledged. That very similar line was in the U.S. Constitution as well. So with that, the 13th is the final, and this is where the amendment process was included or added to the Constitution, or I should say to the Articles of Confederation. So if we could, let's just kind of break this up, because it's kind of three paragraphs. If Tammy, you would read the first one and we can talk about it, then we can read the next one and talk, and then in the final one, it kind of is self-explanatory, but then, Tammy, you can kind of close this that other short paragraph. But let's go ahead and hit Article 13. Go ahead.
Okay. Every state shall abide by the determination of the United States and Congress assembled on all questions which by this Confederation are submitted to them, and the Articles of this Confederation shall be inviolably observed by every state, and the Union shall be perpetual. And the Union shall be perpetual, nor shall any alteration at any time hereafter be made in any of them, unless such alteration be agreed to in a Congress of the United States and be afterwards confirmed by the legislatures of every state.
Okay, so in other words, it's going to require all states to ratify any changes to the Articles of Confederation. Not three-fourths. It requires full unanimity. In other words, everybody has to agree. So that becomes problematic if you have one character, one state, that just doesn't want to play with anybody. So, Sean, let's pick up the next paragraph.
And whereas it hath pleased the great governor of the world to incline the hearts of the legislatures we respectively represent in Congress to approve of and to authorize us to ratify the said Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, know ye that we the undersigned delegates, by virtue of the power and authority to us given for that purpose, do by these presents, in the name and in behalf of our respective constituents, fully and entirely ratify and confirm each and every of the said Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, and all in singular the matters and things therein contained. And we do further solemnly plight and engage the faith of our respective constituents that they shall abide by the determination of the United States and Congress assembled on all questions which by the said Confederation are submitted to them, and that the articles thereof shall be inviolably observed by the states we respectively represent, and that the union shall be perpetual.
Okay, so go ahead. No. Actually, Tammy will read that, but let's kind of talk about what you read, because there are some people, because they look at this part of the Constitution, the Confederation, as, you know, a part of the Confederation, the Articles. It's in the article itself. And so I've brought this up where there have been people that challenge Charlie Kirk and others. Hey, the Constitution doesn't mention the Creator in the Constitution at all. The Articles of Confederation did, right here. The fact is, the Constitution actually did. It wasn't a part of an article, but it was a part of what basically this article included, because technically this should have been a forethought. This should have been a backwards, or whatever you want to call the, you know, you got a preface, and then there's a forethought, right? Or the backwards. help me out here. What do you put at the very end of a book, but it's like a preface, basically kind of covering, you know, why you did this, how you did this?
Epilogue.
Okay. That's another thing you can put in it. I've seen one that I think is for something, and I've seen back something as well. Anyway, okay, epilogue. Here they're basically identifying, and they're kind of reasserting what Tammy read and the spirit of the Articles of Confederation. Anybody know where the Creator or where the divine hand of providence is mentioned in the Constitution?
Probably with the year of our Lord.
There you go. This was done in the year of our Lord, acknowledging that they did this, and it was done recognizing him and his time, in their time. So, nowhere else does it talk about, you know, governing the spirituality of man. You got to keep in mind, folks, that the scriptures, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Bible, was given to us for our spiritual salvation, not as a form of government. Technically, when we really looked at the government that was created by Moses, it was the rule of judges, right?
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that was the first theocracy created that the Bible accounts for. There may have been others, because I would think that maybe around Adam's time with Enoch, there may have been some formal governance that was done in the city of Enoch, because they exceeded, you know, in becoming so righteous, right? They were just caught up. Now, when he created this system of judges, that actually sufficed for Israel for how many years? 400, something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. So until Israel realized that everybody, every Tom, Dick, and Harry country out there, because there were a lot of Harry countries out there, they all had kings. And shoot, Israel was being denied the privilege of having a king lead them. And boy, they needed to have a king. Excuse me. So they pleaded and pleaded, please give us a king. And they dismantled this system of judges. And when you really look at it, the judges was literally just the ability to take care of the temporal controversies. In other words, you know, this woman stole my child, right? We know the story of King Solomon, where it went through the course of judges, finally up to King Solomon, where he had to make the ultimate decision, because he was the final stop in deciding what to do with the baby. And everybody understands, you know, what happened. So we look at this government of judges. It was like a legal system that they used. It really wasn't necessarily anything to do with, you know, the scriptures, even though they did have theocratic laws like thou shalt not work on the Sabbath. What would happen if somebody was caught working on the Sabbath?
They were stoned, I think.
I'm not sure if it was a capital offense, but I mean, they were definitely punished. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, right? All that stuff. So, you know, you had to honor those. And it may have been a capital offense. I'm not saying it wasn't. But that's all of that stuff really changed under the king, and things started softening because, you know, the king was given the latitude. Because under the rule of judges, it was pretty much black and white, if that makes sense. More so than the king, because the king could become more despotic, and we actually saw that, you know, as they went through the, you know, the reign of kings. Nevertheless, you know, when we kind of look at the Bible, the intent of the Bible was for the salvation of man. The framework of a legal system was more for the temporal governance of man, how we were going to get along, how we were going to deal with controversies amongst each other, amongst other nations, and so forth. So this is one of the reasons why governments are instituted. Eventually you get too many people who say, you know, we need to govern ourselves a little bit. We need to reel ourselves in a little bit. It's a little chaotic, a little anarchical. So governments started getting instituted by men. Well, that became the obvious statement for Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. And therefore, constitutions were created, like the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation and the Constitution was not created to, you know, to ensure your salvation. It was strictly a mechanism that, by the inspiration of the divine hand of providence, how we could govern ourselves and live within a land of liberty. That's one of the reasons why the Constitution is so unique. No other government actually created a land or a body of liberty where the Constitution, the authority of government, was based on protecting the people's liberty, protecting their life, and protecting their property. Okay, so, you know, they kind of included it here. Like I said, it's in the Constitution as well. This last paragraph, let's go ahead, because they do the same thing. What you're going to read now, Tammy, is right here in Article 13. Go ahead.
In witness whereof we have hereunto set our hands in Congress, done at Philadelphia in the state of Pennsylvania, the 9th day of July in the year of our Lord, 1778, and in the third year of the independence of America, agreed to by Congress, 15th November 1777, in force after ratification by Maryland on March 1st, 1781.
Okay, Sean, did you catch anything out of here that kind of, you know, caught your eye? Anything?
The third year of the independence of America.
Okay, so in witness whereof we have hereunto set our hands in Congress, done at Philadelphia in the state of Pennsylvania, the 9th day of July in the year of our Lord 1780 or 778, I'm sorry, and in the third year of the independence of America. They agreed to this, but apparently it wasn't finalized. They agreed to this in November 77. But it actually took another 9 months before it to actually get written, before it can go out. Does that make sense? Because that leading line in front of that, because that bottom line just basically says they agreed to this, the Continental Congress kind of agreed to doing this, to the essence of these articles. These articles really weren't finished and pounded out until 1778 on July, what is it, the 9th day of July, 9 months yeah. later. So the Articles of Confederation actually didn't get done. I'm just kind of creating a more accurate timeline. It didn't get done until the 9th of July in 78 instead of November 77. So it took three more years to get ratified. But it took a long time from 1776 to 17, it took basically 2 years. 2 years and 7 days, or 5 days if you go by the fourth, from the Declaration of Independence. So anyway, just pointing this out, that things weren't happening as fast as possible just due to the fact that they were under attack. And, you know, things were pretty serious when it comes to living and surviving in wartime, right? I mean, so it was difficult for them to meet and to make this happen. And it kind of speaks to that. But it also speaks to the fact that if you don't have clear heads, you're in a rush, sometimes you rush to compromise, throwing more reasonable things out the window or things that would have worked better out the window. So I'm just basically laying that out there. All right, so that's... Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to just make the comment that's why I thought of that third year of the independence of America. When you actually think about it and think about what had just occurred, and now that they were a new nation under no government, really. I mean, because they're still putting it together.
Right.
And they still managed to get to the point where they got to with the Constitution eventually and where we are today. I mean, it's just amazing. I don't think people nowadays even had the capacity to understand. It's like I tell people, if you want to appreciate what you have, go somewhere else where they don't have it. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the things that is probably worth mentioning is when we look at the Articles of Confederation and that time frame going to the Constitution, this evolution that this nation was going through, this group of sovereign states. First off, they weren't looking to consolidate into a single government. They did not want a single government. They actually opposed a single government being inflicted, period. They wanted to make sure that the state sovereignty, the legal system, their common law, everything that they've created as their beloved state was going to be maintained. They would have rejected the Constitution if it would have meddled at all in any way with their government and, you know, how they were operating legally, spiritually, blah, blah, blah. So as this moved forward from the Articles of Association into the Articles of Confederation, the Articles of Confederation offered actual powers that could then, the Continental Congress actually had the authority to start doing things. I made it very clear on November 10th, and when we read the Articles of Association, that there were no real powers granted to Continental Congress other than communicating and working with the king to repeal, you know, these taxes or to grant us representation. And so when we look at today, how government kind of sometimes assumes powers that it shouldn't have, sometimes those things are based on real necessity because they didn't realize that they were, after they petitioned the king, they were going to be attacked. They didn't think the king would attack them. You know, they said that they were the most loyal. We love you. We honor you. But we can't stand idly by as Englishmen and watch our rights be taken away and eroded. So anyway, you know, there was a lot of learning that they had to go through. And as they started granting the power, they realized pretty quickly that Continental Congress did not have a lot of power to do anything, which is one of the reasons why, as the war started, you know, stemming down, and when Washington finally won that final battle, and he was with Cromwell, and bottom line, you know, he ended the war. They signed the initial treaty. They left, and then the Treaty of Versailles was signed. The reality is this, is that the state's paradigm was, yeah, we have this instrument called the Articles of Confederation, and it may protect the small states, and the small states may actually, you know, use this as a mechanism of protecting themselves. But even the small states were actually violating it and working around it, like Rhode Island, by devaluing their currency. I mean, everybody was doing what they could to marginalize and to literally allow this confederation and the union to erode to nothing. It was in a very dangerous place because the power granted was definitely never, not at all, sufficient for what it needed to do, for it to be perpetual, like it said there, perpetual. So the true perpetual government was created in the Constitution. And it became truly a gift. And I'll even say that the framers all agreed, and I say this all the time, they all acknowledged and agreed that the divine hand of providence inspired and guided that instrument in its creation. Therefore, now before we get to the Constitution, we have a little few bumps in the road. Because they finally got this Articles of Confederation done, and in February, before the full ratification, a month later, they already pounded out an amendment to the Articles of Confederation, and this is a significant amendment. It's a short amendment. This is why I kind of want to have this read, and so I think we left off with Tammy. So what I'd like done is, Sean, if you would read the very first paragraph. And then, Tammy, you can read the last three short ones. That kind of makes it even. Don't worry about the citation at the bottom, because this is maybe a quarter page.
Okay.
But the name of this amendment, folks, is the grant of power to collect import duties. Okay? So let's go ahead, and Sean, let's read the first paragraph.
All righty, sir. Resolved that it be recommended to the several states as indispensably necessary that they vest a power in Congress to levy for the use of the United States a duty of 5% ad valorem at the time and place of importation upon all goods and wares and merchandises of foreign growth and manufacturers which may be imported into any of the said states from any foreign port, island, or plantation after the first day of May, 1781, except arms, ammunition, clothing, and other articles imported on account of the United States or any of them, and except wool cards and cotton cards and wire for making them, and also except salt during the war. Also, a light duty of 5% on all prizes and prize goods condemned in the court of admiralty of any of these states as lawful prize. You want me to go on? I'm sorry.
No, actually, you kind of went into Tammy's, but that's okay. We'll kind of pick that up when we come back, because just needed to do the first paragraph. But folks, we'll be right back and kind of discuss these taxes and so forth and the need to collect. So the whole point is, why were they doing this? We'll be right back after this short break. Thanks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so one of the things that they needed was funding. And they realized that basic requisitions upon the states wasn't going to work because the states just weren't going to follow along. So what they ended up doing was they basically kind of followed suit of what Britain was doing, but the difference between what Continental Congress was doing and what Britain was doing in the Stamp Acts and these other taxes was Britain actually had armed guards or a standing army to make sure that those taxes were collected, that you actually segregated that money to be set aside to pay for those specific taxes. Well, Continental Congress saying, hey, we need to kind of create a very similar mechanism. So what they did was they laid out a duty, which this duty is kind of like when you look at a sales tax. A ad valorem is a transaction, a one-time transaction of the sale of property, sales tax, that type of thing, when you buy something. And specifically, when you're buying property, a horse, maybe a slave, if it's qualified as property, because, you're going to use it, and down the road, they may actually have a property tax. But this is the transaction of purchasing a 5% on the purchase value of this good or these things that were being supposedly imported. So anyway, what they were laying out were these mechanisms of being able to start collecting taxes on the normal transactions and the normal consumption of very specific things, which is in that very first paragraph. They did all of that except salt during the war. In other words, they didn't want, because salt was a necessity for preserving food and all of that, and it was considered a strategic necessity for everybody. So they wanted to make sure that they weren't going to place tax and put a burden on your cost of salt. Now, 5%, is that reasonable? Anybody? How much was the stamp tax? How much were some of the taxes that Britain was putting on?
I have no idea.
Technically, if I understand it correctly, most of the taxes were somewhere around 1% or less. 5% was a pretty significant tax. So let me ask you, do you think the people of the states were kind of, hey, this Continental Congress, they suck? Right? I mean, yay, we're fighting a war because we're getting taxation without representation. And okay, we have representation, but we can't afford that. Because that would, 5% is kind of steep.
Now, representation isn't free.
Yeah. So I found it kind of interesting how, as I look at the engagement and the discussions during the Constitutional Convention of how they wanted to create a greater burden on new states joining the Union, and how when they actually started talking about taxation, boy, they were pretty ambitious in being able to say, yeah, we want to take a lot out of the people's pockets, or take a lot from the people. And, you know, hold on here. Why? What are we paying for? We're not going to run an education system. Bringing up the sore spot of yesterday. But anyway.
So are you saying, GR, was this a tax that if import came into that state, then the state had to charge the tax and then pay the Congress?
So, yes, this is a tax that Congress wanted to put on a duty of 5% ad valorem for per transaction at the time and place of importation upon all goods, wares, and merchandises of foreign growth manufacturers. So, in other words, agricultural, anything that was kind of considered some property that you were buying, a physical property. And going on and on, they basically started saying, except wool cards and cotton cards. In other words, I guess those are kind of like bolts of, I mean, you know what a bolt of fabric is, right? But I'm gonna presume that wool cards and cotton cards and wire for making them and so forth, those types of things were, you know, considered essentials. So they didn't want a tax on those, so they wanted to make sure they had an exception for those things, except and also accept salt during the war. So anyway, yeah, they actually said, we need money. We got to fund this war. We need money. And now, my sentiment is that when this went out, the people saw this, or the states and the state, you know, committees of correspondence and down to the local provincial governments, because that's who they were communicating to. They were probably looking at this going, oh, no, this is not going to land well with the people here. Right? You know, can't we fight a war without you having to put your hand out and taking money from us? I mean, people really think that way. People think that our liberty is going to cost us nothing. Just do it. Can't you just do it? So, anyway, my impression, because as we look through these amendments, some of these kind of repeat on how they can collect money, because they were not getting the money they needed so that they could buy the stores, the ammunition, the necessities to prosecute the war. They weren't trying to feed the needy, or educate the dumb, or the uneducated, I should say, because I think dumb is somebody that can't talk. But anyway, I don't think that this was received very well. And I think that's one of the reasons why they had to come back with different approaches of taxation. But let's go through this and finish this. Go ahead and pick it back up with also a like duty of 5%. And read those last three paragraphs. And then let's look at what they included at the back end of this to see, did they actually ask for the ability to enforce this? Let's go. Go ahead.
Okay. Also, a like duty of 5% on all prizes and prize goods condemned in the court of admiralty of any of these states as lawful prize, that the monies arising from the said duties be appropriated to the discharge of the principal and interest of the debts already contracted or which may be contracted on the faith of the United States for supporting the present war, that the said duties be continued until the said debt shall be fully and finally discharged.
Okay, so they didn't put any mechanism in there for them to come out and coerce or to basically force the states to pay these taxes. They're asking them to collect these taxes and to pay them based on these transactions and so forth. Okay, so there is the First Amendment. Let's dive into the Second Amendment. And interesting title, folks, because we want to read this one. Amendment to give Congress coercive power over the states and their citizens. Now, just based on the title, how do you think this landed?
That doesn't sound good at all.
Yeah, so, okay, they're not going to be happy when they see this. They want coercive powers? What did we, you know, what can of worms did we open here? You know, maybe the remedy is far worse than the problem, so to speak. So this is kind of long, and so what I'd like you to do, Sean, is kind of read this through, and let's find a good point that can stop kind of halfway through. You see, in the very middle, it says, by the said 13th article of the Confederation. Let's kind of end it right there. Do you see that?
Okay.
It says, whereas it is further declared by the said 13th article. If you want to just actually stop before that line, and Tammy can pick it up from there. Okay?
All right.
All right. So that would be the second whereas. Actually, the second one on the left, right? So it stands out.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right. Whereas it is stipulated and declared in the 13th article of the Confederation that every state shall abide by the determinations of the United States and Congress assembled on all questions which by this Confederation are submitted to them, and that the articles of this Confederation shall be inviolably observed by every state, by which article a general and applied power is vested in the United States and Congress assembled to enforce and carry into effect all of the articles of the said Confederation against any of the states which shall refuse or neglect to abide by such their determinations, or shall otherwise violate any of the said articles, but no determinate and particular provision is made for that purpose. And whereas the want of such provision may be made a pretext to call into question the legality of measures which may be necessary for preserving the authority of the Confederation and for doing justice to the states which shall duly fulfill their federal engagements, and it is moreover most consonant to the spirit of the free Constitution that on the one hand, all exercise of power should be explicitly and precisely warranted, and on the other, that the penal consequences of violation of duty should be clearly promulged and understood.
So that's like promulgated.
Okay, promulged.
There you go.
I'd like to hear him say it.
Right, well, so you know what promulgate means, right?
Right.
Okay, it's basically to distribute, to send out. Okay. All right, so let's dissect.
I wanted to throw this at you. The cards, the cotton and wool cards, that's what the devices they would use to string out the cotton to make fiber.
Uh-huh.
And they were made of metal. That's why it says in the wire to produce them.
Right.
It was like something they used to make a loom, sort of.
Right. So in today's, you know, when you buy fabric, it comes on bolts. You know,
right.
They're not a long stick of steel with threads in it, with most guys would think of a bolt. Right. I mean, so it's just a way of putting the fabric, the raw wool that's been probably turned or spun, same thing with the cotton, what have you. And so that's...
Well, it's part of the process of spinning. It was...
Uh-huh. Right. Okay, yeah, correct. And so it's the recipient of the spinned fabric, but you have to basically take that and start, I believe you have to loom it or stitch it together to make cloth. This is not cloth. This is literally just the raw threaded wool, raw threaded cotton. Yeah, and so, again, back in those days, they did a lot to clothe themselves and to eat and to stay warm. I mean, you know, basic functions like that we, you know, have businesses and corporations take care of for us. You know, they had to do a lot and understand how to do those things. So, anyway, but the point is that those things were being exempt from taxation because they understood the essential needs for people to have clothes, for, you know, the protection, that type of stuff. So, anyway, okay. So, let's look at what they're talking about here. They're basically pointing out that the Articles of Confederation said, hey, you're going to abide by this. And you're not. And so this, you know, nobody likes being held accountable. And it's always difficult to tell people, hey, you're supposed to pay and trying to collect debt and so forth. Until you create that solid relationship that you're going to have to do this or we're going to come after you. Let's look at the first time and let's look at the message sent with the Whiskey Rebellion. This was the first time the federal government was challenged on we're not going to pay these distilled taxes. What was the charge? Treason.
Treason?
Yeah, treason. In other words, your failure to abide by the constitutional law. Let's think about that. If they created a uniform rule of naturalization and a state failed to abide by that because the players in the state government said, yeah, we're going to do this and we're going to undermine this, wouldn't that be equally treason? Yeah.
It sure is.
Okay. So my point is, I'm not trying to necessarily create a direct connotation, but what I am saying is that they took, you know, the federal coercion to be very literal in when they talk about treason, that is basically rebelling against the Constitution. Even if it's just one little thing, look at what happened to treason and how it's impossible for charges to come forward because they've redefined it. The courts have actually redefined treason to mean that it has to be whoever you're colluding with actually has to be an identified enemy that we are at war with. There's these qualifications that the courts have created that are just, forgive the expression, it's just asinine.
It's self-preservation is what it is.
Right. So,
because they know their treason is.
Right. So, and I like the way they spelled federal, because it's pronounced federal, but I mean, technically the beginning of that word is faux, right?
Right. Where I come from, it's F-A-U-X.
Oh, okay. F-A-U-X, yeah, faux. So this is an enemy. Foe is an enemy, right? Identify friend or foe. IFF.
I mean, they, yeah.
So anyway, both. Right. Well, this, it's kind of interesting how they use kind of an enemy droll. I'm just trying to point out the obvious. I'm just stating the obvious.
Okay.
So Tammy, let's go ahead and pick it up where he left off to talk about, whereas it is further declared by the 13th, because what they're doing is they're literally proving that, hey, you guys are obligated to be doing this. And now, if you're not going to do it, then we need coercive powers to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. And whereas it is further declared by the said 13th Article of the Confederation that no addition shall be made to the articles thereof unless the same shall be agreed to in a Congress of the United States and be afterwards confirmed by the legislatures of every state, the United States and Congress assembled having seriously and maturely deliberated on these considerations and being desirous as far as possible to cement and invigorate the federal union that it may be both established on the most immutable basis and be the more effectual for securing the immediate object of it, do hereby agree to and recommend to the legislatures of every state to confirm and to authorize their delegates in Congress to subscribe the following clauses as an additional article to the 13th Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union.
Okay, so they're actually wanting to add this clause that's going to follow. Okay, so Sean, go ahead.
It is understood and hereby declared that in case any one or more of the Confederated States shall refuse or neglect to abide by the determination of the United States and Congress assembled, or to observe all the articles of the Confederation as required in the 13th article, the said United States in Congress assembled are fully authorized to employ the force of the United States as well by sea as by land to compel such state or states to fulfill their federal engagements and particularly to make distraint on any of the effects, vessels, and merchandises of such state or states or of any of the citizen thereof wherever found, and to prohibit and prevent their trade and intercourse as well with any of the other United States and citizens thereof, as with any foreign state, and as well by land as by sea, until full compensation or compliance be obtained with respect to all requisitions made by the United States and Congress assembled in pursuance of the Articles of Confederation.
Okay, so they want to actually force the states to start basically applying pressure, distressing, as it says, distressing these merchants, the people of their state, for this money. Or we're going to come and we're going to do it for you with force. Interesting. So here's the interesting thing, and this is why I say that by the time, what's the date of this? 16 March 1781. I think this is technically a week or two before the full ratification of the Articles of Confederation. Either way, it doesn't really matter. This is happening at the same time it's being ratified. The final state ratified it. Now, we're well into the war. We're 2 years away from the ending of the war and the declaration of peace in September 1783. So about 2 years plus, a couple months. But the point is that everybody is starting to see that they got away with creating a document that didn't empower the general government of the Confederation to be able to do anything. And that, you know, hey, it's their butts on the line because, you know, with all these debts with these foreign nations, it's not ours. We're not legally bound. They can ask us, but, you know, they're the ones that, you know, have to be held accountable. In other words, the states themselves did not take, you know, I think when I die, I'll probably have lots of people say, you were completely wrong on this, you know, that lived in these times and say, no, you know, we didn't marginalize. But the way I see it, they did. They did everything they could to game the system. At least that's my take. Am I wrong? I see today how money comes out of the federal government to offer this or that, and it's all unconstitutional, mm-hmm. and the state legislatures jump. I mean, they jump at the opportunity of gaming the system, don't they?
Yeah, totally.
And we see the same thing down in counties. I'm sure everybody has seen these obscene roundabouts that are being pushed into America. Why is this? Folks, go Google traffic calming, DOE or DOT, and you will find that this is an international move to deploy roundabouts throughout the metropolis and throughout rural areas, or I should say urban areas, to ensure that traffic is always encumbered. It is a calming effect to ensure that nobody can go from one point to another and hit all the lights and not be encumbered. In other words, the way we were managing traffic with lights and a light system was allowing the flow of traffic to be far more efficient fuel-wise and everything else, to where at a roundabout, it doesn't matter what time or who's going to work this way or that way, the roundabout slows everybody down 24/7. A traffic light system will allow the flow of traffic going into town to move more efficiently so that you don't hit and stop at every light. Well, with a roundabout, you get hit every time. If they put roundabouts at every intersection, then it's going to encumber you and your trip into work would exponentially expand. Increase if they got away from the sequencing of lights and so forth. And in some places in rural areas, they'll put a roundabout where they had a light that would be green for the most part, and it would go off other than yellow lights flashing on the ancillary roads hitting the main road. In other words, you know, in the middle of the night, there would be no light at all for the main road, and there would be a yellow light for the, you know, the two cars coming to basically either cross or to, you know, merge onto the road. Why? Because it's the most efficient way of helping traffic move. When government is seeking efficiency to help improve productivity, then they are a partner in our economy of productivity. When government creates encumberments, permanent encumberments, to restrict and or reduce your productivity, they have become antithetical to their purpose of serving us. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And so we need to start challenging this crap. But nevertheless, back to these articles and this very specific amendment, there's no doubt in my mind the states could, there were states that ratified this. There was just one state that said we weren't. And I don't know about these first couple, but I do know that some of these states these amendments were being ratified. They just couldn't get unanimity. They couldn't get everybody to acquiesce. In other words, Rogue Island was always the bad actor that says, no, we're not going to allow you to come in here and collect from us. And that's all it took. So in fairness, I think, you know, sometimes we'll use a broad brush. Maybe those in Rogue Island, maybe a couple of other states that were gaming the system, I think some of the other states were really trying to do the right thing. But bottom line, it is a natural, I don't want to say natural, innate, or, you know, something within us all to game. But I think when we lose our mores, not our morals, but basically the fundamental mores of society, in other words, like not just ethics and morals, you know, trying to live righteously, when we lose that, then our propensity of taking advantage of a system, taking advantage of others and so forth, almost becomes a part of life. And that's why we see people today that constantly look at government programs as games to participate in, you know, or, you know, like the money being handed out for childcare and healthcare, you know, clinics and so forth. It's being gamed. Not doing anything. So this is all being exposed as we see these things. And back in those days, I guess the majority of the people weren't gamers, but it seemed like Rogue Island was. And I'd love to, you know, love to find a group of people that really go out of their way to say, we're so sorry, you know, the United States into the Union of the bad, you know, the problems we caused, and boy, we'd love, and this is how we're going to make it up. You know, some penance, something like that. But anyway, all right, so Sean, I think you're the one, or actually, no, Tammy, you've got this next one. So let's go ahead and read this short little, we don't have time. I will go ahead, we'll kick this off tomorrow in our next show, and I will kind of just, so we can summarize on this, because there was only this couple sentences. Anyway, I'm sorry about that, folks. I'm J.R. Mobley, and we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. And the way we need your help is we need you to get engaged and start leading. We're here to empower you so that you can start leading with us. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.